This is day six of this July 2013 7-day session. And today we'll take up a koan. This is from the Mumon Khan, number 38, A Buffalo Passes Through a Window. And this is the case. Goso said, "It is like a buffalo passing through a window. Its head, horns, and four legs all pass through. Why doesn't its tail too?" Short case, but packed with rich rich material on the self, the nature of the self as it relates to enlightenment and practice. We'll save the we'll wait to read the commentary until later, commentary and verse until later. A little bit about this Goso, let's use his Chinese name because we won't be using it too much. It's his Chinese name is Wu Zhu Fayin. And looking to our great source of biographical material, a book called Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson, translated by Andy Ferguson. Find here Wu Zhu Fayin, also known as Qing Yuan. That name will be familiar to some of you from the ancestral line, the Qing Yuan, Qing Shi, Qing Yuan, Qing Shi. His dates are 1024 to 1104, which places him in the Sung Dynasty. That's the dynasty after the Tang Dynasty, which has gotten the reputation of being the golden age of Zen, the Tang Dynasty. There are scholars who make a strong case that the Sung Dynasty was just as rich in Zen masters and great Zen accomplishments as the Tang Dynasty was. Wu Zhu's teaching exerted profound influence on subsequent generations of Zen teachers and on wider Sung Dynasty society. He left home to become a monk at the age of 35, which is quite late compared to most of these guys. He traveled to a city called Chengdu. Chengdu, I can confirm, Chengdu is referred to in China as one of the four furnaces of China. I was there in August. And it's the only place I've been where just sitting perfectly still, I had sweat pouring off me. And I don't sweat much. It's the biggest city outside of the province of Tibet. So some of the... I've noticed that stories about Tibet and Tibetan... The terrible persecution of Tibetan monks, and that these stories are filed from Chengdu. Anyway, he went there to study the consciousness-only school of Buddhism. This is there are two main divisions of Mahayana Buddhism, the Majjhimika school and the consciousness only school. Zen is of the consciousness only school. The premise being that all that we perceive is a projection of our own mind. But it says Wu Zhu was troubled by the proposition that when a bodhisattva enters the way, wisdom and principle are eclipsed, and though environment and mind are reportedly realized as fully united, that's the consciousness only part, no evidence can be offered to affirm the truth of this unity. I'm not sure what this means here, that when the bodhisattva enters the way, comes to enlightenment, wisdom and principle are eclipsed. Perhaps it just means seeing beyond these things as terms, as concepts. But he was bothered that there's no way of empirically verifying the realization that mind and environment are not two. Things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. This is another way from drawing from our affirming faith in mind, another way to understand the principle of the consciousness only school. So, troubled by how one can really understand, how one can know this non-dual truth, Wu Zhu went to another kind of Buddhist master, asking about the nature of knowledge, epistemological questions. And to these questions, the master said, if a person drinks water, he personally knows hot and cold. This is another mark of the Zen way, is direct experience. It reads here that while this helped to clarify Wu Zhu's understanding, he said, then hot and cold can be known, but what about knowledge of the self? And he went to another teacher, and said, if one does not know the self, how can one understand principle? But this teacher didn't answer, and he just told him, if you want to be clear on this, then go to the south and attach yourself to a teacher of the Buddha mind doctrine. That's the Zen school. So off Wu Zhu went. It reads here that this went on an arduous, long and arduous journey, and he found a couple of Zen masters, but neither of these teachers brought Wu Zhu to a full awakening. And then one of those teachers, before he died, he directed Wu Zhu to go to another teacher. And when Wu Zhu met this other teacher, Bai Yun was his name, he asked him about a certain story. And just when he finished asking the question, Bai Yun shouted at Wu Zhu. And at that, Wu Zhu came to enlightenment. And he offered the following verse. Before the mountain spreads the plain, repeatedly with folded hands, I ask the elders. They sold to me so many times, and yet I purchase more, just to know that pine and bamboo bring forth the cloudless wind. He had 22 Dharma heirs. He attracted a lot of students, came from all over China. Here's one time when he was addressing his monks. He said, "Yesterday when I went into town, I noticed a puppet show going on. I couldn't help going over there and taking a look. The puppet was really something to see. At first sight, it seemed to move its limbs, walk around, and sit down all on its own. But when you look closer, you could see that there was someone behind the blue curtain. I couldn't help but call out, 'Sir, what's your name?' And the man behind the curtain replied to me, 'Honored priest, just watch the show.' Why ask for names?" And then Wuzhu says, "Brothers, when I heard him say this, I didn't have a single word to say in reply, nor a single idea. Can any of you say anything in my place? Yesterday, that single instance of embarrassment has uprooted all my ideas now." What's your name? Who is it? What is it? Just watch the show. Why ask for names? There's a famous koan about man sitting atop a 100-foot pole and how he has to step forward from the top of the pole. And so a monk here brings this to Wuzhu and says, "At the top of a 100-foot pole, how does one go forward?" To which Wuzhu said, "Quick, try it and see." Really, going forward from the top of a 100-foot pole means going beyond oneself, having the courage to just go beyond really what one knows, what one understands, venturing into what is beyond all that. This is really what we're called upon to do all the time in Zazen, at every level of practice. Is to step forward from the 100-foot pole. The night that Wuzhu died, it is recorded that a great rock fell down nearby Mount Shi, creating a sound heard for 40 miles. Be that as it may, we'll go now to the case. This koan was considered by Hakuin to be one of the eight most difficult of all the koans. But an enormously important one, dealing as it does with the nature of the self, seeing through the self, what the self means. Wuzhu said, "It is like a buffalo passing through a window. The buffalo here is certainly was originally a water buffalo. Water buffalo is a symbol of true mind, true self. The 10 ox herding pictures can also be considered the the 10 buffalo herding pictures. We have these above the main door of the Zen Center at Arnold Park, showing the stages of enlightenment. The buffalo or the ox representing mind. In the earlier stage, catching a glimpse of this mind shows this figure, man or boy, catching a glimpse of the mind and then progressing through to accommodating this mind, taming this mind, going beyond. There's a completely blank circle, and then ending with the figure entering the marketplace with helping hands, or sometimes entering the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands, the final stage of this endless journey of practice and training and enlightenment. Here Wu Zhu sets up this scenario of this buffalo passing through a window. I remember Roshi commenting on this case and relating how once when he was in Southeast Asia, he found himself having to bed down for the night in a barn that he shared with a water buffalo very close by, and how amazing it was, how awe-inspiring this creature was in its size. This is the Asian water buffalo has these huge horns that come way out. It says its head, horns, and four legs all pass through. This massive head, these great spreading horns, four legs of this behemoth water buffalo. All of that passes through the window. Why doesn't its tail? What makes this such an evocative simile is that the tail of a water buffalo is so small. It's a little bitty tail. It's not like a horse's tail or a... it's completely out of proportion to the rest of it. That's how small it is. And all the rest of it goes through, but not this little tail. This koan confronts us with the difficulty of understanding the self and working with the self. We say that the buffalo represents our true self, Buddha nature, true mind, or just mind. Over time, there's a great deal that has been written and taught about mind and self and Buddhism. Really, it's all about mind and self, you could say. Even the term Buddha nature might ask, well, if it's true that there's nothing outside this true self, this Buddha nature, then why? How is it that we even have a word for it? The problem I always had with the notion of God is that it's as soon as you give it this sense of a being, then you limit it, or him or her or whatever. But you know, we're really do in Buddhism, we're really doing the same when we use the word true self, or Buddha nature, Buddha mind. It's the nature of things that when we give them names, we limit them. So why do we give them names? Because otherwise, there's only a rare person or no one who could relate to any of this, who could grasp it at all. Awakening reveals that there is no fixed, permanent, discrete self that exists from one moment to the next. I've found a passage in the Lankavatara Sutra, which is one of the most esteemed in the Zen school of the many sutras. This was supposed to have been Bodhidharma's favorite sutra. And there's a passage here where the Buddha is talking about this, the illusory nature of the self. And he asks, and what does it mean that beings have no self? The assemblage of the skandhas arises from ignorance, karma, and desire, and includes neither a self nor anything that belongs to a self. The skandhas, we mentioned this appears in the Prajnaparamita we chant it every day. It's the constituents of the self, such as it is. He also, in the Lankavatara Sutra, it also just runs through that. We say it in the Prajnaparamita, form, feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself. These are the different components of what we call a self. And that these coming together creates the appearance or the illusion of a self. It arises from ignorance, from karma, and so forth. As the grasping and attachment of such senses as the eye to form give rise to consciousness, bodies, houses, and the world of objects that are perceptions of one's own mind are fabricated and manifested from one's own projections. They change and disappear every moment like a river or a seed or a candle or the wind or a cloud. He's referring to the world of objects, what we see as objects apart from us. Restless like a monkey, attracted to impurities like a fly, and insatiable like a wind-blown fire, they move like a water wheel through life after life and bodily form after bodily form, impelled by habit energy without beginning, like figures produced by some sort of magic trick or spell or mechanical device. To be skilled in the knowledge of such appearances means to know that beings have no self. So, in other words, the world of the ordinary person is the world of appearances, of forms that we give names to. And this world of forms, different millions of different kinds of forms and shapes that we give different names to, creates the appearance of things out there apart from a self here. Now back to Buddha nature. We can really find fault with having any term at all to point to what is beyond form and beyond words. In fact, you could say that that the term true mind or Buddha nature or true nature, that these are all synonyms for God, the ultimate principle, the ineffable. At least for a more sophisticated understanding of God, what the experience of enlightenment reveals is that there is no agency. You could talk about God if you mean this illimitable, boundless, incomprehensible, mysterious something, but there's no agent there, one who does something. That's what we reject in Buddhism. And the same with Buddha nature or true nature. There have been philosophers and great thinkers who have said, by calling it Buddha nature, aren't we setting up a kind of a selfhood to it? There's something there, when in fact there can't be, because there is no selfhood to anything. But here in the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha says that he gives this word, he uses these words like Buddha nature or true nature, because without it, the whole notion of a formless self would be inaccessible to most people. It would feel so remote. To awakening of any level must be a seeing into the emptiness of form. Seeing that, as Hakuin says, as we chant in the Hakuin chant, our true self is no self. Our own self is no self. Seeing the emptiness of the self is just the beginning. It's seeing the emptiness of all forms, all ideas, all concepts, words, notions, principles, ideals. This emptiness is called shunyata originally. The void nature of all of this world of forms and appearances. So the the head horns and four legs, all this stuff passes through. But then there's this little tail that doesn't. And that little tail doesn't want to go through. One of the great Soto masters, the Dharma heir of Dogen Keizan, Keizan Jokin, he said, "Though you find clear waters ranging to the vast blue sky of autumn, how can that compare with the hazy moon of a summer night? Most wanted pure white, but sweep as you will, the mind will never be empty." As much as we want the whole water buffalo to go through, this little tail remains. And to Keizan's master, Dogen, there's no beginning to practice and end to enlightenment. There's no beginning to enlightenment and end to practice. We can reach a deep states of absorption called samadhi and think that the tail has passed through. And later we discover that it hasn't. And the Buddha addresses that too here in the Lankavatara Sutta, as have his descendants. Many of the great masters have clarified that samadhi is not the same as Buddhahood, as supreme perfect enlightenment. Here's one part in the Lankavatara Sutra. In fact, their consciousness does not cease when they enter samadhi. It doesn't cease because the seeds of habit energy are not destroyed. Here's another one. This is very sobering. That though they keep passion from rising, the force of its energy remains. Addicted to the bliss of samadhi, they dwell in affliction-free realms. But having no final goal and having no place to retreat to, in their samadhi-born bodies, they pass through kalpas unaware, like someone who is drunk, who wakes up when the wine wears off. Their awakening is the same, and their Buddha body too. A warning that we shouldn't mistake the bliss and the formless state that we call samadhi with really full transcendence of karma. This koan is about karma. It's about habit forces. We touched on this yesterday, the day before in Taisho. This is the work of not just Zen, spiritual practice, contending with habit energy, the ways that each one of us, in our own particular ways, keep reverting to habit forces and the way we move through the world and engage with people. Broadly, we can we can understand karma as the many forms of greed, anger, and delusion. Greed, ill will, hostility, and delusion. Every minute we are offered the choice of creating more karma that we will have to contend with in the future, or not doing so. And it starts with the way we use the mind. This is the great thing about meditation. It goes right to the root of karma creation, is the way we use the mind. The Buddha said, thought manifests as word, word manifests as deed, deed develops into habit, habit hardens into character. Body, speech, and mind. In these three ways, we are continuously generating karma that then we will have to reap. In a more contemporary, informal way, we say, first you create the habit. First you make the habit, then the habit makes you. So in Zen practice, we are going right to the source of karma, and that being thoughts, and noticing thoughts without getting drawn into them. This is really our work, is to notice that there are thoughts without getting drawn into the content of them. There's a very fine line. To see, to notice thoughts as they arise, but still ignore them. Notice them, but ignore the content of them, not be drawn into the content of them. This is like a millionth of a second difference. Because our habit, there's that word again, our habit is to, when we see the thoughts, is to then allow ourselves to be caught by them, snagged by them, drawn into them. If we can avoid that, if we can just cut it off as soon as we spot the thought in the mind, then this is the work of unraveling our karma, our habit forces. It is so humbling after awakening to see that we still get caught in our egoistic habits of thought, speech, and action. We've seen that the self is a no-self, and yet it's like it's like no, I'm not gonna get into that. Let's go on to the commentary. Mumon says, if you can penetrate to the point of this koan, open your eye to it, and give a turning word, you will then be able to repay the four obligations above and help the three existences below. If you still cannot do so, work with the tail single-heartedly until you can really grasp it as your own. Well, again, this is the work. We're all working with the tail. We, in working on mind, we work with the tail. The more clear we become, and the more absorbed we become in this realm of no mind, the more the stuff of the mind is exposed. This is one of the things that's so challenging about Sesshin. As the days go by and we get a sense of greater spaciousness and openness and freedom from our thoughts, still, we see with ever greater clarity the residue of the mind. The verse, passing through, it falls into a ditch, turning back, all is lost. This tiny tale, how extremely marvelous. Passing through, it falls into a ditch. What's the it? What's the ditch? These are points in the koan. What's the passing through? The koan, the case says, the tail doesn't pass through. Turning back, all is lost. The absence of clear sentence structure here is what makes koans often so rich with interpretations. It's left to the student to understand what is being referred to or whom is being referred to in many cases. That's I'm told, is the Chinese language. All these koans are originally in Chinese. That it's a very vague language. It's not clear often about the references. Turning back, all is lost. This tiny tail, extremely marvelous. What is marvelous about this tail that won't pass through? So marvelous about this tail that keeps swatting us in the eye. When we had a visit from a Japanese Roshi who had been friends with Philip Kaplow in Japan, and someone asked him, one of us asked him, how long did you work on Mu? And his answer came startling swiftness, he says, I'm still working on Mu. The buffalo is Mu. The buffalo is mind. Then what's the tail? Is the tail apart from mind? How can it be? When everything is mind, nothing is outside this mind, this Mu. When you have a wart on your hand, can you say it's simply part of the hand? Or is it not part of the hand? You could argue it either way. It's not part of just a normal, healthy hand. It's something in itself. We give a name to it, wart. That suggests that it's not. It's somehow distinct from the hand. But you can't say it's separate. It's not. No hand, no wart. Another koan, Mumon, asks, is this one? Is this two? So many creatures have tails. Where would dogs be without their tails? Makes them dogs, complete. We want to see the dog wag the tail and not have the tail wag the dog. Some people see the marvelousness of the tail as it's having instrumental value, like the grain of sand in an oyster. They say that the grain of sand is an irritant to the oyster, and the oyster forms this pearl, what comes to be a pearl, around the grain of sand. What starts with a source of pain then becomes this lustrous, precious thing. Well, that is okay as far as it goes, but what is marvelous about the tail is not just the way it can keep us practicing, even beyond when we feel that we've seen through this mind, seen through self and other, us and them, and all the rest. How extremely marvelous. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.